Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I post episodes periodically on pretty much whatever I like, so welcome back. Follow me on Instagram and on Twitter at @UgandanBabe, all one word. You also have the option to rate and review the podcast on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, so please consider doing that and then come right back. We have a lot to discuss. Now, today's topic is quite broad and maybe fairly controversial, so I did feel like I was all over the place in trying to get my thoughts together. In the end, I didn't even want to do it, right? I was reluctant to address it at all for precisely that reason. But the reason this topic came to my attention is that if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, then you know that I do commentary on history, current events, and pop culture. I'm also fairly active on social media, by which I mean I'm a lurker, right? I lurk on the socials. I don't post all that much, but I follow goings on, mainly on Twitter, although actually these days I'm a bit more of a TikTok babe. So I will follow conversations on there that are of interest to me. And one of the conversations that always gets a lot of engagement is on the interpersonal relationships between straight men and straight women. For obvious reasons, I think. I mean, it is quite literally the only basis on which our species can continue as we currently know it. So that will always be of interest to me. Oftentimes, this ongoing discussion is framed as a gender war, which the Urban Dictionary defines as a so-called war that is occurring online between straight males and straight females. On one hand, you have women pushing the narrative that all men are misogynistic, cheaters, abusers, narcissistic, and uncaring. On the other hand, you have men pushing the narrative that women are superficial, only caring about looks, money, fame, height, etc. Disloyal, promiscuous, dishonest, and inherently evil. Wow! Anyway, it's all very exhausting. But it does have real-world consequences and has resulted in all sorts of movements, such as the MGTOWs, that is, men going their own way, men's rights activists, pickup artists, incels, and then most recently, the passport bros. From women, it birthed misandrists and divesters. I think those are the ones I've heard. Please look up these terms if you're not familiar. Otherwise, we will literally be here all day. But I think the point is pretty well summed up in the Urban Dictionary definition of the gender wars, with each sex coming to the conclusion that the other is largely irredeemable and then acting accordingly, with varying degrees of disdain, contempt, and even violence. Now, I won't go into the details about what I think about any of these movements. Frankly, I think there are more than enough commentators in this space, but I don't want you to leave with the impression that I think that these are equal sides of the same coin. I don't. But we'll leave it there for now. The aspect of all this that I want to explore is summarized in a sentiment that I have increasingly begun to see online. And this is an idea often expressed by straight men that single, child-free women are selfish. Now, I've been out in the internet streets for a while, and this is something new, or at least it's something new to me. And I remember when I first saw it, I was kind of surprised and a bit confused. I think I laughed it off, and although I was taken aback, I didn't pay it much attention. I hadn't yet begun to connect the dots that would eventually lead me to a fairly frightening place, but more on that later. As time passed, I began to see the sentiment repeated in different forums when the subject of single women was raised, particularly single, child-free women. And it's being raised a lot these days for good reasons, which we will get into in a bit. But what eventually prompted me to start writing out the script for this episode was a tweet that I saw of this lady complaining, or let's say, expressing her dissatisfaction on this topic. So she says, "But why is it that some of you get so furious when other people, especially women, say they don't particularly feel like having children. How does that impact you? Why do you react as if it's a personal insult to your preferred life choice? It looks pretty exhausting to be you. Girl, I get it. So I did a little scroll-a-thon through the comments, and there were a number of attempts to answer the question, some of which sort of made sense to me. So for example, someone said, they're ours because all children are of public interest. The biological parents are the primary custodians. Now, I understand how this might sound outrageous to someone from, let's say, a highly individualistic society. The wording is a bit jarring, right? But one idea that I think all of us can appreciate is encapsulated in the saying, it takes a village to raise a child. If you believe in societies being constructed that way, as opposed to individualistic societies, then yes, the well-being of all children is a community concern, or it certainly should be. Now, whether that concern extends to their creation is precisely the point of this episode and ties into the next comment I saw, which says, because women are more valuable in reproducing. The demographic collapse in the West will show you why the mindset of not wanting kids is not good for society. End quote. I'm going to spend most of my time on the second part of that comment because that is where my primary interest lies. But before I do, let me issue two caveats. The first is that because we're speaking about the interpersonal relationships between men and women, there are necessarily at least two parties involved, or two perspectives, let's say, you know, men and women. However, as with almost all social constructs, this one is gendered, which is to say that criticism is usually directed at women. So please don't come at me with, but what about men? Because if I had to address it from all angles, we would be here all day. And frankly, we would miss the point. The second is that there'll be a number of generalizations that I mentioned based on societal norms, as well as from the research and studies that I'm going to cite. Many of the assertions I will make will not apply to all individuals in a particular group, right? An assertion seems to be true in most situations or for most people, but that may not be completely true in all cases, and nothing is absolute. So please keep that in mind. Now that that's out of the way, let me first briefly address the first part of the tweet where the poster says, women are more valuable in reproducing. If you've been listening to this podcast for some time, it will come as no surprise to hear me say that I think this idea is absurd, and I wouldn't have spent any time addressing it if not for the fact that I like to be crystal clear on where I stand when it comes to these kinds of things. I believe that every single human life has innate value. The ability to procreate does not come into it at all, and it only takes a few minutes of critical thinking for this to become inescapably clear to those that are not brain dead. There are countless examples I could give to illustrate this point. For example, think about the millions of people who died before they ever had the chance to procreate. Those that died prematurely from disease, accidents, war, or, you know, one of 100 reasons why people do not live to see a full life. The soldiers, for example, who sacrificed their lives in wars, fighting for some noble ideal, many of whom didn't get the chance to live a full life. Were their lives less valuable because they did not have children? Even if you are a purely, quote, logical person who just wants to crunch the numbers and assign human beings a numerical value of worth, let's take a man or a woman who, instead of becoming a parent, dedicates their life to discovering a cure that goes on to save the lives of millions, if not billions, of people. Is his or her life any less valuable than those who choose to become a mother or a father? Let's be serious. trying to assign value to human life on the basis of whether or not that life chooses to procreate is an exercise in untethered stupidity, in my opinion. But moving on to the second part of his comment, the demographic collapse in the West will show you why the mindset of not wanting kids is not good for society. I think this is a pretty well-known phenomenon, but for those not in the know, there are a number of countries in the West and even in the East that are facing this looming crisis of demographic collapse. Some notable examples include Germany, Greece, Japan, China, and South Korea. These countries have fallen or will shortly be falling below the replacement fertility or population rate of about 2 children per woman, which indicates that a generation is not producing enough children to replace itself, eventually leading to an outright reduction in population. But not only are there more people dying than are being born, the population as a whole is aging. So you end up with a society with a lot of elderly people. In Japan, for example, about 30% of the population is over the age of 65. And in 2021, the population fell by 820,000 people. By comparison, in Africa, the world's youngest population, only about 6% are over 60 years. Moreover, the population is projected to continue to grow and will hit 2.5 billion by the middle of the century. But back to countries like Japan, China, South Korea, things are looking pretty dire demographics-wise. And there are real concerns about how to keep the society functioning with a shrinking base of productive young people. I won't get into the details of all that, but hopefully it is fairly obvious what the practical concerns would be when, for example, pensions are not sufficient to care for the elderly and there are not enough workers to keep the economy running, yeah? Which brings us back to that Twitter comment about, you know, the mindset about having children leading to demographic collapse. Not having children, rather. The idea here is that people, and especially women, who choose not to have children are selfish. That it is our biological imperative as a species to procreate, and therefore a woman's duty to birth children. Now, it's all well and good to parrot, you know, who cares about an impending demographic collapse? Aren't there like 7 billion, almost 8 billion people on the planet as it is? We are overpopulated as it is. And there are even more extreme views, you know, like the nihilists and the antinatalists, who even see procreation as a moral wrong. But that's not my worldview. And I think most of us can begin to appreciate how difficult life might get in an increasingly aging world. This is probably a bit more challenging for us as Africans to picture right now because, as one German acquaintance pointed out to me recently, one thing that stands out to him on his visits to Africa is how young and vibrant our countries are. And having lived in Europe for some time and seen the difference myself, I get it. It seems to me that for those of us rooting for the continuation of the species, it is much better to have a society that is mostly young. We love our elderly people and, you know, life is a journey at the end of which we must all age and die. But I think most of us can probably agree that a vibrant society is a mostly young society that can properly look after the vulnerable, including the elderly. I think even the elderly would agree with that. So, if we accept that demographic collapse is a real challenge that we will have to face, what are the solutions? And are taboos around people choosing not to have children part of that package of solutions? There will, of course, be other solutions to be considered, but I'm not going to go too much into those details because this isn't a research paper. I'm not an economist or an anthropologist. So there are other people that are way more equipped to delve into all that. Plus, they're not the point of interest of this episode. However, there are a couple of points that I do want to highlight on this before we address the question of whether we should be browbeating people, especially women, into having children. Going back to the East Asian countries facing the greatest threat of demographic collapse, so China, Japan, South Korea, part of their problem, it seems to me, is this deeply ingrained and entrenched ethno-nationalism and even racism and xenophobia that have resulted in, for example, Japan having some of the strictest immigration and refugee acceptance policies. As with most other parts of the world, there is little appetite for sizable immigration, whether it's from neighboring countries or far-flung places. As I've said in a previous episode, the one on ethno-nationalism, it was an early episode, I think, like episode 3, I can see the upsides of maintaining a largely homogenous society. There is more social cohesion, you know? We're all ethnic Japanese people, so we have a shared cultural understanding. It makes it easier to govern. I get it. There's also the pride that you take in having a unique culture and identity. I think there are a number of valid points in favor of taking such a stance. However, on balance, in the face of this grand existential crisis, which could threaten the very continuation of a people, is it perhaps worth revisiting this anti-immigration stance and allowing higher rates of immigration and refugee resettlement, which usually translates to many more young people coming into a country and stabilizing the population? This is the route that Germany, for example, has attempted, not without some challenges. However, mass immigration introduces a whole new set of problems. Because, for example, for the countries that these people are immigrating from, what are the reasons for their immigration? Wouldn't they prefer to stay home if home was a safe haven where there were opportunities for a decent life? There are so many downsides to leaving or being forced to leave your home. Isolation, loneliness, lack of social support that comes with being close to family and community, loss of identity, discrimination. There is a whole host of challenges. Families are separated, communities are depleted and broken up. And this phenomenon can be observed the world over. When communities and countries fail, young people leaving their villages, heading for the cities, and from the cities overseas, leaving entire communities, towns, even cities as so-called ghost towns. Whether it's American cities like Detroit, Italian villages like Riace, or South Sudanese towns like Lukangol. So, mass immigration poses its own challenges. There are other policies that are being considered. So, for example, again, Japan is already implementing incentivizing women and families to have children through financial assistance to help with child rearing, preschool education, nursing care services, and workplace reforms. I think all these make sense. But unfortunately, there is little evidence that these policies are having a significant impact. As I said, it's a complex problem. But the point of that whole long spiel is to say, even with all these different solutions being considered, from mass immigration to financial assistance, it still leaves the question as to whether people, especially women, are obligated to bear children. Before we delve into what women think about this question, let's first consider whether we are even asking the right question. Now, stay with me. I provided a pretty straightforward explanation of what demographic collapse entails: a rapidly aging population with an insufficient workforce to support the economy. This definition is predicated on a variable that we haven't challenged yet, and that is a capitalist economy. I've said in previous episodes that I do not consider myself to be a socialist or a capitalist. In fact, I don't know enough about economic systems to make a definitive argument for or against any particular one. I have had many arguments in favor of capitalism, that it is the most effective way to distribute wealth, that it has lifted millions out of poverty, that alternatives have failed abysmally in comparison, and on and on and on. But I'm not convinced. I said in my previous episode, the one about BTS and geopolitics, that currently the poorest half of the global population owns just 2% of the global total, while the richest 10% owns 76% of all wealth. if that is an effective system of wealth distribution, then let's just call in the Intergalactic Federation and pack it in. It is an indictment on our intelligence, creativity, and competence as a species. I am embarrassed for us. This is embarrassing and shambolic. I truly want to believe that we can do better. Okay, but Kentaro, this is not something that we can solve overnight. Progress comes gradually, and capitalism has solved many problems and brought us forward further and faster than any other economic system we've attempted to date. Okay, fair enough. Perhaps this impending demographic collapse is an opportunity to reassess. Is it the population that is collapsing, or capitalism as we know it? This system that is built on indefinite and unsustainable consumerism and growth, is this a system we want to maintain? Or is it perhaps time to seriously go back to the drawing board and come up with something that actually makes sense? A world in which the global south is not looted to fuel growth elsewhere, where multinationals and corrupt politicians aren't aided by financial policies and systems that allow them to pillage their countries unchallenged, where workers are paid a fair wage that doesn't require working multiple jobs just to stay above water and mortgage their lives simply to have a roof over their heads, where most of us aren't just one health crisis away from poverty, where a quality education will not put you in debt for decades and millions of children don't die from starvation and treatable diseases, all while we plunder, pollute, deplete, and destroy the only planet that we can currently inhabit. I believe in us. I truly believe we can do better. Okay, fine. Now we have fixed the economic model. We are no longer chasing unsustainable growth to feed the capitalist machine. Things are looking better. That still doesn't address the fact that more people are dying than are being born. The population is aging and will begin to decline by the end of the century. Our shiny new economic model may not require indefinite, unsustainable growth, but we still need a stable population. We need to, at the very least, replace ourselves. Fair enough. So let's go back to the question of why people, particularly women, are choosing to not have children, and let's investigate the reasons for it. I came across an article about a study that attempted to answer this very question, and the findings were interesting, let's say surprising yet not. Let me explain. The article is from February 2023 and is by Martha Gill, a writer for The Guardian newspaper, and she points out that women have more money and more choices than they have ever had, but are not having as many children as they would like to have. It then goes on to run through the possible reasons, such as economic factors like housing, income, and childcare costs. However, this doesn't quite explain it, because the group for which birth rates are falling the most are wealthier millennial women. We see this all the time, where working class and women, even under the poverty line, have many children, while the middle and upper class restrict themselves to just one or two. Perhaps it's career penalties for women who choose to have children. Here, the fear is that having a child will impede your career progression. However, if you look at the Nordic countries like Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, which have the highest maternal and paternal protections and support, those women still have declining birth rates. So perhaps it's female empowerment, you know, that movement that seeks to promote women's sense of self-worth, their ability to determine their own choices, and their right to influence social change for themselves and others. This encompasses a number of ideas, including equality for women from a legal perspective, such as the right to vote, to education, to employment, property ownership, but also redefining the role of women in the home and in society, and critically, reproductive rights to contraceptives and abortion. That undoubtedly has contributed to the decline in birth rates. But what about the women who want to have children but just haven't? Why are they having less children or even no children at all? In this article, Martha Gill concludes that it comes down to women having not found suitable partners. So you have women who are perfectly happy to have children, many extremely eager, some a bit more relaxed, some ambivalent, but all willing to have children, right? But they're unable to find suitable partners. The definition of a suitable partner is necessarily varied, right? But there are some common themes that have emerged when modern women are asked to elaborate. And it includes things like emotional maturity and availability, good communication, and equal partnership. So that is women, that is men who are willing to share the burden of raising children and maintaining the home. So it's no longer enough to simply bring home a paycheck. And the historical constructs and penalties that women faced around their decisions to marry and procreate are steadily losing their power. In the past, social stigma was a useful and effective tool in bringing women to the table. Women that were unmarried or child-free were ostracized. They faced shaming, exclusion from society, and were not afforded status or protection. And there were other penalties, notably economic uncertainty and the threat of physical harm in the absence of a man to offer his protection. So women had little choice other than to partner up and bear children as society dictated. In many societies across the world, there have been marked improvements. You know, women can earn a living and live independently. And it is slowly becoming socially acceptable to be unmarried and child-free. Of course, the stigma still persists, even in the most progressive countries. But many women, particularly educated women, are no longer being forced or coerced into marriage out of necessity. They have more freedom as to who and when to marry and have children. And this ability to choose has led to some women choosing to not get married or have children. Women are saying, if I cannot find a suitable long-term partner, someone that I can share this responsibility of raising a family with, then I would rather opt out and remain child-free. That's just one side of the coin, though. People who want to have children but have not found a suitable partner. What about those that have found a suitable partner but either limit the number to one or two, or more critically, choose not to have children at all? This is a category of people increasingly being referred to as child-free. So, as opposed to those who have not yet had children but presumably want to, and then of course those that are unable to have children because of fertility issues. I looked up some studies on this from the US, Australia, Europe, and Asia. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any for Africa. But the trends appear to be global and with very similar outcomes. The balance of available research, summarized best by a paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, suggests that the larger culprit behind declining marriage and fertility is not economic in nature, but better described by the amorphous bucket of, quote, cultural change. Another study from Harris Interactive and the Archbridge Institute provides evidence that the predominant reason cited by Americans, for example, who do not want children, is a desire to maintain their personal independence rather than economic pressures or even environmental concerns. A simplified way to read these findings is that both men and women are considering the question of whether or not having children will bring them fulfillment and happiness. Now, please remember that this particular study focused on couples, so parents, and then child-free couples. The research findings are surprising but consistent. There is no evidence that parents report significantly greater happiness than non-parents after controlling for relevant social demographic differences. In fact, across the board, happiness levels have been reported highest among child-free women. Mothers are the least happy, while fathers benefit the most from being married and having children. Please don't shoot the messenger. I'm just reporting the numbers. You can look up the studies yourself and shout at your computer. I'll have them linked in the show notes. But I did find these results extremely interesting. Now, there's always the question of reliability and agendas and who is sponsoring these studies. So I always try to exercise skepticism and caution when reading the results. But they have been pretty consistent across researchers and regions since the studies began in the 60s, so I'm inclined to take them at face value. The point is that some people, even when they have a good partner, simply don't want to have children because they value things like personal independence more than having children. They believe they will be happier without children. And when you step back from it all, it kind of all starts to make sense. Now, I personally think children are wonderful, but we can all agree that parenting can be very challenging. And perhaps personal happiness is therefore not the point of the endeavor, although it may certainly be a byproduct. Perhaps the point of having children isn't just to find happiness and fulfillment. And as the studies show, it may in fact not ever deliver on this promise, whatever your circumstances. One of the articles I read put it this way: happiness is a nuanced concept that's made up of life satisfaction, which is how happy you are with the way your life is going, and well-being, which is how you feel on a moment-to-moment basis. While having kids does boost your life satisfaction, it comes with a tremendous amount of responsibility and daily stress. This results in a roller coaster of very high highs and low lows over the course of their experience of parenthood. End quote. So, maybe the hecklers are right. Why should anyone get to opt out of the project? Why do parents get to bear this obligation to carry on the species, which results in them not being any happier than their child-free counterparts? Maybe it is unfair. And before you jump up to say, but that is what they chose to do, let's consider why people choose to have children. Because it is what we are supposed to do. Because if we don't do it, we will die. We will quite literally die out eventually. So evolutionary biology gave us the first tools, the sex drive and the instincts to become parents. So, for example, women will often speak about, you know, feeling broody, that instinct within your body to have a child. And then Mother Nature also made babies the impossibly cutest thing under the sun. You see one and you just want one. But maybe that wasn't enough to seal the deal. Did we perhaps, as a society, a long time ago, decide that we needed to roll out the programming that says marriage and children are the path to fulfillment and happiness, to ensure that we kept doing what we needed to do to carry on? Did you decide that we needed to construct beliefs, rituals, and critically taboos that ensured that the majority of us continued to toe the line? We needed to make sure that anyone who departed from the programming was punished, because if we didn't, the rot might spread. If too many of us spent too much time thinking about whether we wanted to or not, we might opt out of the Great Commission to go forth and procreate. I don't know. The research certainly seems to suggest it. Because if child-free women are the happiest demographic, why should they choose otherwise? And so I think this is where the charge of selfishness comes into it. And perhaps it is a fair accusation. And the only reason we haven't been able to see it as such before is because the programming has been working. The narrative that having children is the greatest source of happiness and fulfillment has been drummed into us so concretely that how could the accusation of selfishness be fair if women were forfeiting this path to happiness? Because it isn't the assured path to happiness, as we have discussed from the research. For women, at least, the most assured path appears to be being child-free. But God forbid you should say it, you will like be accused of being bitter and delusional. But if you've been paying attention, you know, there are possibly other arguments beyond happiness for having children, you know, satisfaction as a whole being one. Okay, but if you're still with me, we have come to the conclusion that yes, indeed, women who choose to remain child-free are indeed being selfish. By the dictionary definition, they are concerned chiefly with their own personal profit or pleasure. They have rejected the programming and chosen their own happiness over their duty to procreate. However, are they being any more selfish than parents? After all, parents too have children for selfish reasons. Some just love children and want them. Others want the social acceptance, recognition, and status afforded to parents. Others want someone to love and to love them back. Others need a retirement plan, you know, someone to look after them in their old age. And still others speak of wanting to leave a legacy behind. These are all selfish reasons. How many parents are really choosing that journey in order to sustain the species? Let's be serious. So, everyone is being selfish. Now what? In the past, the taboos and penalties inflicted by society saw shaming, shunning, and disempowerment of child-free women were sufficient to keep women in line. But today, technological advances and women's empowerment have given child-free women the freedom to choose to be selfish. So, what happens next? Many are still hell-bent on employing the carrot and the stick in a desperate attempt to bring women to heel. For the women who are still willing to make the attempt but are struggling to find a suitable partner, shame is still a powerful tool. The message I've been hearing from various quarters, from the pulpit to the manosphere, is that modern women's standards are too high. Who do you think you are? What do you even bring to the table? You're getting old and will hit the wall sometime in your mid-30s and become invisible to men. Then you will die alone and miserable with your many cuts. So, many women, bruised and battered by the stick of shame, acquiesce. They pick a man who doesn't meet their requirements and make the leap with mixed results. Some go on to have reasonably bearable marriages and bear children. They are content with a bargain, or they are deeply unhappy but persevere. Whatever unhappiness they endure is sublimated. They are fed the carrot. Welcomed into the fold, they receive the honor accorded to devoted wives and mothers. Regardless, they have done their duty to the species. Others still make the attempt, so they find a partner, they have children. But for whatever reason, the partnership breaks down. Infidelity, domestic violence, emotional, physical, and financial abuse, or even the obscure but handy irreconcilable differences. For whatever reason, the partnership dissolves. But these women too have done their duty. They have procreated. The question is it enough? These same women go on to face the wrath of society. In America, for example, the derogatory use of the term baby mama is pervasive. They are pitied, disrespected, abused, and God forbid they should need financial or other support from the community or the government. They should not date, have sex, or have any kind of intimacy. Ideally, they should morph into a superwoman only concerned with and consumed by the lives of her children. The prized offspring are left in the wake of all the penalties that these single mothers are subjected to, with a, quote, fatherless moniker hanging over their heads. Now, this of course doesn't happen to all single mothers, but I'm not going to quibble over the fact that baby mama and single mother are often lobbed as insults at women who, for any number of valid reasons, have children outside the protection of a long-term partnership with a man. Just the other day, I saw a tweet about a bill that will soon be considered by the Parliament of Uganda. Under the Assisted Reproductive Technology Bill, unmarried women will be barred from getting IVF, so that is in vitro fertilization, one of several techniques available to help people with fertility problems have a baby. So basically, it seeks to block single women, unmarried women, access to fertility solutions. Now, I'm a firm proponent of two-parent homes. I believe that the ideal scenario for child-rearing is two devoted, loving adults. But I also live in the real world. Partnerships break down for many valid reasons, and obviously there are many women who fail to find a suitable partner, and many single women who raise happy and well-adjusted children despite the challenges. If you're really concerned with the continuation of the species, you should seriously reconsider your support of such a bill. So the carrot and the stick is still very much in use, either to persuade women to have children or to shame them if those children appear outside of anything other than a long-term partnership, specifically marriage, however miserable. In addition, there are even more frightening institutional sticks unfolding. In America, for example, the hard-won reproductive rights of the second wave of feminism are being rolled back. Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022, and abortion is now being criminalized in many states under the banner of conservative Christian politics, further pushing women away from relationships and the threat of unwanted pregnancy. So we come to an impasse. Many women have made their choice and chosen to be child-free. And the penalties and taboos that worked historically have only a waning power. With a freedom to choose, many are choosing not to accede to society's demands for offspring when the decision to do so will not necessarily yield the advertised happiness and fulfillment. What will happen when the rubber hits the road and the demographic crisis is upgraded to a code red? What happens if these so-called selfish women refuse to heed the call to action? Will the problem be resolved through a combination of cultural and economic policy changes that account for a shrinking and aging population? Will technology perhaps come to the rescue? Will we roll out the robots or the frankly frighteningly dystopian bionic babies to be gestated outside the womb? Or will we reverse decades of progress and strip women of their autonomy and reproductive rights and somehow force them to bear children? Now, if you think that this is unnecessary scaremongering, you only have to look at Afghanistan, where after decades of relative freedoms, the theocratic Taliban government have once again relegated women to second-class citizens. What other abuses and atrocities can be justified once you introduce the threat of demographic collapse? I really hope we go for the first option. I hope we can restructure our economies and our societies supported by technology so that they don't make the decision as to whether or not to have children unnecessarily harder. As I conclude, I want to make one point crystal clear in case it somehow got lost in translation. Now, of course, I don't believe that single and or child-free women are selfish. Or rather, I don't believe they are any more selfish than parents, as we already discussed. The choice of whether or not to have children is inherently selfish, whichever direction you go. They may have chosen their own happiness over having children on unfavorable terms, but that choice has not been made without much sacrifice. It has taken courage and the willingness to face the wrath of a society that is not at all sympathetic and is often even violent. On top of all that, these women form an integral part of that village that is raising the children that we spoke of at the start of the episode, right? Many of us, in fact, I would argue the majority of us, have a heart for children. We love them, we treasure them. We see the hard work that good parents put into raising them, and we recognize the joy that they bring and the hope that they embody for our future as families, as communities, as countries. And we contribute to the effort with our time, with our resources, with our emotional labor. We are the friend or the sister or the aunt that you call on for help in a pinch. We contribute financially to our wider families and communities in 101 ways, even when we are overlooked and undervalued because we don't have a man on our arm or a child at our skirts. And we have always been here. The difference is that we are more visible, more vocal, and we have more political, economic, and social power. And that upsets the cat a bit. At the end of the day, whatever women choose to do, there will be penalties. there will always be someone with a lot to say about it. Say a woman chooses to have children. If she's a stay-at-home mom, there are many who will have something to say about it, and there are challenges that she faces in that dynamic. If she chooses to work, she's a power-hungry careerist putting her career before her children. Plus, her career often takes a hit. She often even ends up doing more than her fair share in providing for the family and raising the children and taking care of the home. If for whatever reason, she ends up a single mom, still more will be said. Even after she has done her part in combating the extinction of the species, it is still not enough. It is very often a thankless task, with the odd Mother's Day bouquet or graduation and wedding speech thrown in before everyone goes back to living off their physical and emotional labor. And finally, if a woman chooses not to have children for any number of valid reasons, she is a selfish harridan only living for herself. Increasingly, women are learning to ignore the noise and exercise their hard-won right to simply choose. As always, thanks for listening. Give us a like and subscribe to the channel if you enjoyed this episode, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter at @AUgandanBabe to continue the conversation. I hope you'll be back for the next one. Goodbye for now.